You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Western honeybee, which is estimated to play a role in bringing one in every three mouthfuls of food to your plate, has been called the glue of our food system. But for over 5 years now, honeybees have been dying off in startling numbers, and scientists, researchers, and beekeepers still don't know exactly why. Joining me now for a look at the leading suspect and some of the other possible culprits is Time Magazine senior writer Brian Walsh, whose article, The Plight of the Honeybee, is the cover story, although on the cover it says, A World Without Bees, a whole other suggestion there. It's the cover story of the August 19th issue of that magazine. I'm very pleased it has brought Brian back to our show. Hello, Brian.
Good to be here.
When did beekeepers first start to notice that this has become a widespread problem?
Well, you might remember the term colony collapse disorder, and that beekeepers really started to notice that about the middle of the last decade. They had been suffering, actually, some pretty heavy losses going back to the late 80s when something called the Varroa mite was accidentally imported into the United States. This is a really nasty bug that we can talk about a bit later, but it was, it had an impact on hive supplies, but they were still getting by all right. And then about the middle of the decade, they started noticing their hives would simply vanish. I mean, the bees would vanish, the hives would be left. You'd still have honey, you still have beeswax, you still have comb, but it would be gone. And that sort of started first, you saw it in Pennsylvania, and then it kind of spread different parts of the U.S. It was eventually seen internationally as well. And scientists gave it that name, colony collapse disorder. And to this day, we don't really know exactly what's behind it.
And it's so common, it's often called CCD.
Right, exactly. It's got its own very fancy acronym in that way, too. And even though, in recent years, there's been less of that specifically, that sort of vanishing disease, you still are seeing very high levels of death. I mean, this past winter, honeybee colonies, they were about one-third of them either died or disappeared.
How hard is it to replace a colony once it's collapsed?
Usually what beekeepers will do is that they can import a queen from sort of a specialized queen breeder, that's the queen bee, and if they have remaining living hives, they can introduce the queen into one of those hives, and eventually the hive will kind of split off. Some will go with the new queen, some will stay. That's a way to engender a new colony.
But what had happened to cause the collapse? Did the queen die?
Well, I mean, in terms of the colony collapse, they're still not sure, really. I mean, what happens usually with a hive that's dying, the queen will die, but so will all the other bees as well. You might see a few bees left over, but once you've lost the queen, once you've lost sort of a tipping point number of bees, the hive really can't continue.
You're right that bees add more than $15 billion in value to farming each year. Which crops are particularly dependent on honeybee pollination?
I mean, we could probably go for the rest of the show just naming all of them. I mean, you can start with almonds, which are probably the most valuable crop pollinated by bees, worth some $4 billion. Apples, apricots, cucumbers, zucchinis, keep going. Basically, almost every fruit and vegetable out there, with the exception of the big grains and meat.
Now, you said that almonds represent $4 billion a year. Were there problems with pollinating them this year?
It came very close to the edge. Every year in the spring, basically you have about 1.6 million colonies of bees are taken over to Central California, where the almond orchards are. I mean, California produces about 80% of the world's almonds, and they have a big pollination event. And as I said, that's $4 billion. That's twice the value of California wine grapes. And so those bees go out there and they pollinate the almond plants. This year, they think they'd had just about enough. There was only maybe a few hundred thousand colonies excess, to actually meet those pollination demands. If the weather hadn't been ideal for pollination, no rain, not very windy either, there could have been a real problem. And there could be a problem next year if this continues.
But isn't there a problem in another way? Some people feel that by forcing the bees to just focus on the almond crop, we're kind of denying them the diversity that they need?
That's a possibility. I mean, you're definitely asking honeybees over the last 20 years or so to do things they've never had to do before.
Yeah, they would go from flower to flower. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's an almond tree. Oh, there's a rose bush. They could go pretty much mm-hmm. anywhere. But when you put them in these huge almond tree forests practically, they have no choice. It's only almond trees.
Well, it's not even so much that. It's probably the stress that comes from moving them around. I mean, if you're one of the big commercial beekeepers, you might overwinter your bees up in Idaho or the Dakotas, and then you move them maybe down to Florida at one part of the year. Then you move them over to California to do the big, valuable almond pollination. I mean, that can put a lot of stress on bees. You're going to lose a few along the way, and certainly it's not something they're used to.
Replacing bees that are victims of colony collapse disorder is probably very expensive. Are many beekeepers going out of business?
Quite a few, actually. I mean, they think they've lost, you know, up to 3/4 of commercial beekeepers just over the last 15 or 20 years. And what you really see, because the cost of beekeeping is going up, I mean, as you point out, if you have to replace your lost hives, you have to get a queen, then you sort of lose some honey production along the way while you're splitting your hives. That costs money. Increasingly, beekeepers need to actually supplement the feed of their honeybees by getting sugar or corn syrup or a honey substitute because the bees simply aren't producing enough. So all of that adds up to it, and it's something that, you know, either it's a bit like with farming, like you either go big or you go home. And so the beekeepers that are on the edge are the ones that are kind of getting out of the business.
You spoke to Jim Doan, whose family has been keeping bees for generations. At one point, he had almost 6,000 hives. Mm-hmm. What's happened to his business over the last few years?
Well, he's been hit really hard since 2006 with colony collapse disorder and just with those repeated colony losses. You know, he kept trying to replace his hives. He's been doing this for quite a long time. His father was a beekeeper before him. He told me the coat of arms in the Doan family, going back to England, actually has a bee as well. So he's been someone who's been doing this his entire life. And just he's found that the cost of replacing those bees, and I think also the psychic cost of going out there and seeing this creature, these creatures that you're taking care of, die repeatedly is just very frustrating. So he's decided really, this past spring, he's going to be getting out of the business. He's sold the land that he owned that had been renting out for farming and for beekeeping. And if he can find someone to take over the business or take over the equipment, he'll do so.
Well, as beekeepers hang up their smokers, will we be losing their expertise?
I think so. I mean, you know, someone I talked to, a beekeeper, told me, you know, we can replace the bees. I mean, bees are very good at regenerating. We've seen that. I mean, we've been able to keep up colony numbers even while losing lots of individual bees. But if you lose the beekeepers, you're losing, you know, decades of experience with someone like Jim Doan, and that's a problem. And then, you have that situation where you might have a few beekeepers producing more and more colonies, and that's problematic as well. I think you'd rather have it spread out a bit more, because if something happens to them, a disease, a pest, you could have a real problem.
My guest is Brian Walsh, a senior writer at Time magazine, whose article, The Plight of the Honeybee, is in the August 19th issue of that magazine. I hadn't realized that honeybees aren't native to North America. When were they brought here?
They came over with European settlers in the 17th century.
And did they thrive immediately?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that the Native Americans used to say, that the honeybees would kind of precede the European settlers. So they got right into this land. They did quite well, and they were really kept all over the country. But really, modern commercial beekeeping started sort of more like in the late 19th century or so.
Are the reasons that they thrived initially disappearing?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that's another problem. We talk a lot about some of the threats to bees, and one is the fact that there simply isn't the kind of wildflowers, wild pasture land that there used to be. Bees depend on that to pollinate, to actually eat.
Is there anything we could do to ensure that they won't die, like changing what we're planting or where we're planting it?
One issue could be to try to vary the sort of crop cultures we're seeing right now. One big problem, especially really over the last, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years, is that you've seen even more crop monocultures of things like corn, wheat, soybeans, these big commodity crops that right now are incredibly valuable for a whole lot of reasons, but they don't offer much of anything to bees.
But bees are also quite ingenious in finding stuff. I think it was last year that some honey started showing up in Brooklyn that was bright red. Do you know that story?
I do, yeah. And that's evidence that bees will find whatever they can, and they can go, you know, as far as 5 miles to actually forage for pollen.
So they were finding maraschino cherry factory, and they were just sucking up the sugar.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly, which probably good for them, but at the same time, you know, bees aren't really supposed to be eating sugar. That's not naturally what they go for, but it does show how ingenious they can be, and also how they sort of absorb the environment around them, no matter what it is.
So as you say, honeybees can fly up to 5 miles looking for a place to forage. Does that make it particularly hard to pinpoint what's causing CCD?
I think so. For one thing, people weren't really looking that closely before 2006 or so when CCD came to light. We didn't really have a firm fix on this. Now, you know, there's a number of suspects. One is pesticides. There's a certain class called neonicotinoids that has gotten a lot of attention because it seems to have an impact on the honeybee, even at a very sublethal level.
Is that the Monsanto product?
No, actually, that's the
aren't people blaming Monsanto for the death of almost everything these days?
They do seem to blame Monsanto for the death of almost everything, but actually Monsanto doesn't make this. I mean, it's more companies like Bayer are the ones that usually are making those kind of pesticides, and they're used in the U.S. They've been used, I guess, since the 90s or so, and they were adapted because they actually produced less harmful impacts on human beings. They can sort of be, they're called systematic, so they actually go into the plant, into the seed, which should be good, except that apparently it means that honeybees can be, I think, more easily exposed than they might otherwise be.
And their use in over 100 crops, since bees can fly so far, would there have to be a complete ban on their use in order to protect the bees?
Or, I mean, it could be a ban. I mean, the European...
Because France has banned them.
France has banned some uses. The European Commission actually has put an embargo or a partial ban on it for 2 years out of concern for the impact it's having on honeybees and other pollinators. So
have we seen an improvement as a result?
We don't know yet with the European Commission. With France, we actually haven't. I mean, France, despite that fact, is still being hit by CCD. They're still being hit by colony loss, which is one of those things that's often pointed to indicate that there's more than one cause here that's still being sort of teased out.
And complicating the issue is Australia's bees seem largely unaffected by colony collapse disorder.
That's right. You know, and they do use neonicotinoids. So, I mean, that's one more mystery here. And really, when I talk to scientists who study this, they sort of liken it more to something like AIDS, where they're, you know, the bees may be dying of any number of causes. I mean, one thing may push them over, not enough nutrition, the pesticides. I had mentioned the varroa mite. There's some other biological threats as well. You put all
it
those.
It could be a virus.
It could be a virus. There are diseases out there that have been seen, and sometimes the pests spread diseases. So you might have a situation where they're being bombarded by all these negative effects. One thing pushes them over. You don't really know if that's not the sole cause.
And then another one, which you kind of suggested earlier, is blaming the beekeepers for their practices.
Right. There's a term called PPB that some beekeepers like to use, which is called piss-poor beekeeping. And I think especially in those early years of CCD, back in the middle of the last decade, there were a lot of beekeepers who didn't have initial losses and kind of looked at those who did and say, well, you're not doing something right. You're not keeping your bees safe. You're not giving them enough supplemental feed, what have you. But the reality is when you have just year after year of losses that are easily twice or more what you should be getting on an average year, and it's very widespread around the country now, around the world, that indicates there's a lot more than human error going on here.
And we're talking about it at a time when we're seeing frogs disappearing at an alarming rate, bats being affected by white nose disease, and that seems to be a growing problem. That could throw the whole ecosystem out of whack.
It is very concerning. I mean, with honeybees, you know, because human beings take care of them and because human beings need them, you know, you have a class of people out there looking out for them one way or another. But for wild bees, wild pollinators, you mentioned frogs, bats, which are just being wiped out by that white nose syndrome, that's happening, and really there's very little being done about them. And that's what's particularly concerning.
Well, what happens with wild bees? Do they also have colonies?
Wild bees often do have colonies. They have their own hives. They're not in quite the same numbers you see with honeybees, but you know they still need the same things that honeybees do. They need plants to pollinate. They often do pollination on their own. They need food. They can be subject to the same threats as well, chemicals, lack of nutrition, pests as well.
Well, it's been my sense that there have been fewer bees visiting my garden this summer than last summer. Maybe that's just me being aware of the problem.
It could be. I mean, it could also be the weather. You know, it's a terrible rainy day today, and that's bees hate the rain. And often, you know, we had some rain earlier this summer. That's been bad for bees from talking to beekeepers. But also, I think, you know, the same, like as I said, the same impacts that are hitting the commercial honeybees are going to impact those wild bees. And if they don't have the forage they need, especially, I think, if they can't find gardens, or if those gardens are being covered with pesticides that then kill them, I mean, the wild bees will suffer the same fate that we're worried about with the honeybees.
Well, we've seen a disappearance of bees in China, haven't we?
Right. I mean, and in China, they've
actually... What's happening there?
Yes, in southwest China, you know, which is a far more toxic environment than anything you'd see in the United States with the amount of chemicals, pesticides, industrial pollution there, they've lost so many wild bees that they've actually had to start hand-pollinating apple plants and pear plants. So you actually have farmers taking pollen hand with brushes going along these trees and doing it themselves. That might be possible in China. It's hard to imagine that happening here in the United States.
Well, haven't engineers been working on a robo bee?
Robo bee, yeah.
Like a robot bee?
Exactly, yeah. They're a team of scientists in Harvard who have actually done this. And you know, there's a lot of uses it could be. I think, you know, potentially artificial pollination is just one. I could also see it being used for surveillance and things like that. But they look sort of like a bee. They're about bee-sized, so perhaps one day you could use it that way. That said, that'd be a really roundabout solution to trying to deal with this problem.
Have we seen that certain kinds of bees are more resistant to the mites and some of the other problems than others?
With honeybees, there are breeds of bees that actually sort of have – there's Italians, there's Carolinians. There's about 29, I think, subspecies that are known. The class of bees known as the Russians seem to be tougher, hardier, better at fighting off these pests and other threats. That said, they also produce less honey as well.
We have seen animal species dying off each year in huge numbers. That's been a normal process. But if we lost bees, that would probably have a devastating effect on agriculture. Are there things that we can do to our agricultural system to ensure that the bees will survive?
I think more variety is a good thing. I mean, and that means both in terms of gardens as well. If you happen to have a house, if you have a lawn, if you can plant bee-friendly flowers, that can be something. It can be almost like creating a sort of a way stop for bees that might be in the area. Beyond that, I mean, trying to break up some of those monocultures may help as well. Rethinking perhaps how we use pesticides or looking for pesticides that perhaps don't have the impact that these do on honeybees. All those are sort of options that can be done. There's also work being done. You mentioned the different sort of subspecies of bees. There's a team at the University of Washington that's working on trying to breed a better bee, a sort of hardier bee. And I think that's quite promising as well.
You have two separate titles for this article. The cover title is A World Without Bees, The Price We'll Pay If We Don't Figure Out What's Killing the Honeybee. And the inside title is The Plight of the Honeybee. Mass deaths in bee colonies may mean disaster for farmers and your favorite foods. I don't know which one of those you wrote, but do you think that they all are perfectly fine? They all apply?
I think they all apply. I mean, when we say a world without bees, you know, what we're really worried about is even beyond the honeybee to thinking about all those wild creatures we just mentioned. I mean, the fact that we're getting, you know, we lose up to 100,000 animal species every year, most of which we have no idea. We don't know we had them. We don't know we lost them.
They're in the Amazon or
Papua New Guinea,
or something.
Yes, exactly. And we may not feel their loss, but that adds up. And that's very concerning in terms of what this is going to do to our world, what it will do to us. We're moving towards a planet where you have a dominant species, that would be human beings. You have the species that human beings use or depend on, and maybe not a whole lot of room for anything else.
Brian Walsh's article, A World Without Bees, or The Plight of the Bumblebees, is in the August 19th issue of that magazine. We also have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org. Brian, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.